Welcome to the Bigger Pockets Daily Show. Today, we are covering the massive NAR settlement that happened on March 15th. The NAR has sent shockwaves through the industry. We'll also talk about the housing shortage and where we're set to go in 2024. My name's Matt. I'm your host. I'm the managing editor of the Bigger Pockets blog. And we will jump right into the NAR story. So on Friday, March 15th, the National Association of Realtors, aka the NAR, announced that they had finally reached a settlement with the various homeowner groups that had been suing them since 2019. The NAR will pay $418 million in damages and end some of its practices, one of which is the language around commission sharing. The NAR, in their bylaws, don't actually set a specific commission price tag, which all the hoopla about this deal is basically saying that there was never a commission sharing structure. So the lawsuits claim that the NAR violated antitrust laws, which were basically inflating the fees paid to buyers' agents. This is mostly because the NAR requires their listing agents to compensate a buyer's agent in an equal amount to what the listing agent's getting. So for instance, if the commission is set to 6% on a home sale, the buyer is entitled to 3%. The listing agent has to pay that out. And this is a requirement. Yes, the NAR requires that listing agents share fees with the buyer agent. However, there is a bunch of frustration coming from agents specifically on this story that is kind of unfounded. What they're saying is that while most transactions, sure, are 5 to 6% in terms of the actual commission, it's not required. And a lot of the media have twisted the headline to be NAR ends at 6% commission standard. Keyword, standard. The reality on the ground is that what the NAR has is a commission sharing structure, not a commission standard. So yes, the listing agent has to pay the buyer's agent. Most commissions are set at 5 to 6%. And so when we say that there's a commission standard, what we're suggesting is that that is the de facto standard, is 5 to 6%. Regardless of the sharing structure, it's 5 to 6%. There's just no way around that. It's always been that way. And one of the reasons why this is a big case and why the NAR will be paying out $418 million is one, because they know they can't win this case because it has become the de facto standard to pay out 6%. But also because of the commission sharing structure, the listing agent is incentivized to hold as much of the commission in their part of the field as possible. So they're going to list if at 3% if they can get the 3% for their side, which you have to double it. They have to share it with the buyer agent. So it's always going to be 6%. The listing agent controls the market in this situation. Now, the NAR, they came out and they said, we stand by the fact, even though we're not going to win this case, we're going to settle, we stand by the fact that we never set a commission standard and commissions have always been set by the market. They've always been set by the listing agent and they're always negotiable. And yeah, that's correct. However, when you consider that 9 out of 10 agents is considered a realtor, they are with the trade organization, it's pretty obvious that they were inflating commissions. 5 to 6% was the de facto standard. Now, obviously, you know, what I'm about to talk about is my opinion. I actually do have a real estate license in North Carolina, and I'm also going to give a little bit of nuggets on what I was actually trained to do as an agent, which sort of informs my opinion on all of this. You can not like it. That's completely fine. You can disagree with me. During my licensing training, I was told over and over and over and over again, 6% is the average, they said average, commission in this state. Obviously, as a newly licensed agent, when I go into the field, my expectation on every possible listing is going to be 6%, because that's what I was told was the right number to hit. That was the language used. On top of that, I was forced to become a realtor by my brokerage, which was Keller Williams. Keller Williams is ranked the number one franchise, and they have over 200,000 agents across the country. Because of these industry standards, and by the way, it's not just Keller Williams that requires their brokers to become realtors. A bunch of other brokerages require that. When you add up all of the numbers, there is a massive degree of anti-competitiveness that does occur in the industry, because you have multiple different brokerages requiring you to become a realtor, and then the realtor association themselves require you to share your commission, which forces you and incentivizes you to get as much money for your side as possible, which means you're always going to try to list at 5 to 6%, bottom line. So the takeaway here is that, yeah, agents are very upset about what's going on, and a lot of them are scared. They are scared. They feel that they're being attacked. They feel that this is possibly the end of their business, that they're already in trouble because inventory has been so low, sales volume has been so low, so they're not making nearly as much money as they were a few years ago. And then now they're going to have a race to the bottom on commission. And in fact, buyer agents might not even make money anymore. So you might see that go away. Now, I will say, I started at BiggerPockets as a writer in February 2020, and this was a little bit after I was licensed as a real estate agent. And upon all of my observations that I had in the real estate industry to that point, being an agent, being in the KW offices, my first reaction was the real estate agent as a profession will probably become defunct within 20 years. And that was in 2020. So we technically have 16 years until we get to measure that, if it came true or not. This was during the iBuyer boom. So Zillow, all those different cash buyer apps that were coming out, no contact type stuff. Even in the car industry, Carvana was disrupting it. Carvana being the sort of online marketplace for cars. We had all these disruptors. But now, and turned out that the iBuyer thing kind of collapsed on its face, and I was wrong about that. However, now we have these AI tools. Everyone still goes to Zillow to find their home. People in the younger generations are significantly less likely to pick up a phone and call someone to get their questions answered. They're more likely to go online, figure it out themselves, do all of the research before they ever talk to a professional. We know that for a fact. This is probably, in my opinion, the beginning of the end of the real estate agent. That is, I know that is a really, really loaded statement, but that's what this looks like for me. There will be a place in the market for valuable agents, people who have been in the industry for a long time, who know what they're talking about, who do have a large CRM full of contacts and people who they've worked with in the past. But for the most part, you're going to see a massive decline in the number of agents who are actually working in real estate. We will be continuing this conversation on our sister podcast, the Bigger Pockets Real Estate Show. We will be bringing on a New York Times journalist. This will be on episode 920. It will also be a link in the description below. So if you want to hear more about this topic and what it might mean for investors, be sure to watch and listen to that podcast. After the break, we'll get into the housing supply gap. That's a massive crisis in the United States, where buildings been, where it's going, and what investors should know about it.
We know you've heard it before. Cash flow is getting very hard to find. There's always long distance investing, but you may be thinking, I don't have a team, enough experience, or the market knowledge to get in. That's where you're wrong. And it's also where Rent to Retirement comes in. Rent to Retirement offers fully turnkey properties that are newly built or renovated, leased and managed, allowing you to invest out of state with confidence. They've got single family, multifamily, new build, and syndication opportunities across multiple markets. They even have BRRRR deals with immediate equity. Rent to Retirement helps investors learn how to build a bulletproof business plan with the best investment and tax strategies around to help you reach financial freedom through real estate. There's no excuse not to get started in real estate investing when you have the right team and systems already in place. To learn more, visit renttoretirement.com. That's renttoretirement.com.
Or text REI to 33777. Again, text REI to 33777.
Meet RentApp, the seamless, secure, free way to collect rent. Built by a team of fintech veterans behind Square and Cash App, RentApp uses ACH bank transfers to deposit funds directly into your account. You don't even need to download anything. RentApp setup is straightforward for renters, and there are no apps for landlords to download. Both get peace of mind with a digital transaction history. That means no more lost checks, managing a dozen different payment apps, or even wondering whether payment was sent. Landlords say RentApp is the most convenient way to collect rent, and we think you'll agree. RentApp, the free and easy way to collect rent. Learn more at rent.app/landlord. That's rent.app/landlord.
You're trying to close on your next rental, so why is your insurance company dragging its feet? With long lead times and never-ending paper forms, it's no wonder it takes forever to finally get a policy. Modern investors deserve better. They deserve Steadily.com. At Steadily.com, you'll get fast, affordable landlord insurance available online 24/7 in just a few clicks. You can even get next-day coverage, which takes just minutes, by the way, to obtain. And you can do it all from your phone. Steadily was founded by landlords who created insurance products tailored to the unique needs of this industry. It's their sole focus, and that's why landlords nationwide consistently rate them 4.8 out of 5 stars. So whether you've got a single family, short-term, or multifamily portfolio, Steadily.com can secure the best coverage at the best price to protect your properties. Discover how Steadily can save you both time and money on your rental property insurance. Visit Steadily.com for a commitment-free quote tailored to your needs today. This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that a long time ago, before I ever started my real estate business, I turned one of my first primary residences into an Airbnb? And that's the extra income that I needed from Airbnb that gave me the confidence to go out and work for myself and eventually quit my 9-to-5 job. And now I have dozens of Airbnbs all over the country. I've even partnered up with the old David Green on a recent property in Scottsdale to take our portfolio to the next level. And of course, we host it on Airbnb. But you don't need to be a full-time real estate investor to start on Airbnb. As a matter of fact, I was self-managing 10 properties while working my 9-to-5 job, so I know anybody can do it. Think about it this way. You're looking for extra income and going on a vacation. Wouldn't it be great to rent out your space and let your property pay for itself while you're gone? I did this one time. I pitched my wife and my roommate, because we were house hacking, on the idea of renting out our home, and it paid for all of our expenses on a trip to Mexico City. So go and give it a try. It might just change your life, just like it did mine. And I really do mean that. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back. Our next topic is about housing inventory and specifically construction and where we're at on our supply gaps in the country. So it's no surprise that home prices have remained elevated throughout the last several months. And we've talked about several of the reasons for why in the past, ranging from the low interest rate environment that we had from 2020 to 2021, the lock-in effect that's preventing supply from coming back into the market. But what the real crux of today's issue is the severe lack of construction that's happened over the last decade. It's led to a massive, massive supply gap, somewhere in the range of 2 to 7 million units. Depends on who you look at for the estimate there. We're just going to say 2 to 7 million because it's actually quite difficult to measure. So why is there even a supply gap? Well, from 2000 to 2006, housing starts accelerated dramatically. They peaked at 2.2 million units built in 2006. And in the aftermath of the 08 recession and the housing crash, housing starts declined significantly, dropping all the way down to 500,000 in 2009 and 2010. Now, if you don't know, that is a near 2 million housing unit drop in the subsequent years, which is extremely significant and is the core reason why today we have such a high-priced environment. It's also why cash flow is significantly hard to come by. Now, since 2012, 2013, there's been a slow increase in the amount of homes that are under construction, housing starts, and it peaked in 2022 with 1.6 million units started, an 800,000 unit shortfall from 2006. So we're still not even back to the 2000 to 2006 levels. We're still almost a million units short of what we were building 20 years ago. And we're significantly undersupplied. So what does that actually mean for the demand side? Well, it means that one, we're not matching demand, but two, household formation, which is defined as any independent person or group of people who live on their own. Over the last 10 years, household formation has outpaced total housing starts. For example, last year, there were 1.5 million housing starts. So it actually declined from 2022, by the way. But 1.7 million households were formed, which is a deficit of 200,000 units. So what's the takeaway there? Well, it means that housing prices are going to remain elevated so long as housing starts underpace household formation. I mean, the construction sector has to catch up at some point. And they've had way too many hurdles in a way. One, there's a lot of regulations in certain markets that kind of slow the housing start process. There's a lot of permitting that has to take place, a lot of EPA measures for environmental sustainability that are just a bunch of hoops that a lot of developers don't want to jump through. Or when they do, they get bogged down for years. The second part of it is that there was a significant period during the pandemic when supply shortages, so lumber, wire, copper, and all that stuff that goes into the actual manufacturing of those resources, they were way overpriced. Electrical wire was like three times the amount of money it cost usually in like 2021. So for a developer, they couldn't even break even on projects, especially in markets like California, where a lot of those regulations take place. There's no funding to cover the gap of time that they're going to have to spend trying to get permits and everything on top of all of the labor and the material that they need to get. So that was a big hurdle. It doesn't paint the full story because obviously there's an affordability issue, and that's more on the investor side of it. The biggest thing there being mortgage rates. Mortgage rates are a lot higher than they were. So it costs more per month to own a house or a property that you're going to rent out, and it's harder to cash flow. So hopefully if we can get supply back on the market, which now a lot of those supply shortages, lumber, wire, et cetera, not only are they not short anymore, but they're actually affordable again, we should see construction tick up. It should. Theoretically, it should. Obviously, the regulation's a whole other thing. But it should tick up. But the question is where and how long will it take? So housing construction is very regional. For instance, some of the top boom markets from the pandemic, so Miami, Austin, Boise, Idaho, those are the markets that had a massive number of people moving to those cities, thus bumping up household formation, creating massive deficits in the amount of housing needed to meet demand. Because of that, those markets are seeing more construction, but construction takes time. That means it's lagging behind. And it also means that other markets, it might not be as lucrative for a developer to come in because they're focusing on where all of the migration is. So they're going to move their development projects there. And then the markets that are to become the next boom towns are going to be undersupplied. So it's sort of this revolving door of undersupply, oversupply, undersupply, oversupply. So at the moment, most of the construction is occurring in places like Florida's coast, in Texas. And what that means overall for investors is that when you have high demand, it's good for appreciation. It's harder to actually buy once you're there. But as supply builds up in these boom markets that everyone rushed to, you actually might see prices decline because supply is meeting demand, moving towards equilibrium. That actually hurts your appreciation. Just a food for thought there. Perhaps you should focus on where the next place should be. So you should look at where places are underbuilding right now because they don't have to. Buy there because it's likely cheaper than the boom markets like Miami, Austin. And then set yourself up for a situation where once those do become the boom towns, which obviously you can't predict everything, but you can find out based on certain economic factors. When they become the boom towns, you ride the wave of appreciation and win that way. Now, luckily for everyone who's listening, we cover all of this type of stuff on the Bigger Pockets blog. So we're always covering which markets might have the best potential for future investment, what has the best potential for today, what has the best potential in 10 years. We're constantly covering a bunch of data, we're constantly covering market reports, and we're spinning it in a way that makes it make sense for investors. So we covered the NAR story. We'll be covering that situation throughout the next couple of weeks because we know it's going to unravel and a lot of people have their opinions and comments on it. You can also read that story on the Bigger Pockets blog. We'll have that linked in the description below. Please join the conversation. We've already had about 100 plus comments on that article. A lot of back and forth. So feel free to chime in on that. And then we also just talked about inventory. You heard my thoughts on where investors should be looking, the dangers of investing in hot markets, so to speak. You can check out all the stuff we have on the Bigger Pockets blog, biggerpockets.com/blog. That is biggerpockets.com/blog. I'll be here every 2 weeks talking about my opinions on the latest news in real estate and economics. Be sure to listen in. Once again, I'm Matt, and I will see you in the next episode.